Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. I had a couple of really cool stories. I always say that, but I really think this one is cool. It's a little bit not about human health directly, but I just have to talk to you about the interesting things that you get to do if you're a scientist. These scientists actually took a crocodile and put it in an MRI machine in order to measure its brain function. The head researcher, Mehdi Behrouzi, that has this wonderful quote in the article. In the first step, we had to overcome a number of technical obstacles, and the crocodiles could not be sedated. Now, the reason they used crocodiles is simply because crocodiles are so darn old. They are at least 200 million years old, and they haven't changed much in that time, according to the fossil record. So they are extremely ancient, and they really are a link between the dinosaurs and birds. So that's already interesting. And there's been a controversy about dinosaurs and whether or not dinosaurs had vocalizations. And if so, did they have complex vocalizations? So, you know, think about bird songs. I used to have a canary named Enrico. He had the most amazing and complex song. And it was long. It was about a 35-second loop. In fact, I used it as my ringtone. Anyway, getting back to crocodiles. So once they overcame those technical obstacles, they put the animals in an MRI machine and they subjected them to various visual and auditory stimuli, including classical music. So they played them Bach because, you know, if you're going to play music to a crocodile, it should be Bach. What they did was they looked at the animal's brain activity. This is functional MRI, so it looks at where the blood flow is and where the glucose consumption is. And they gave them classical music, they gave them simple sounds. And what they found is that the processing that was going on in the brain of the crocodiles was virtually identical to the processing going on in birds and humans. So when you're listening to my speech, the parts of this complex vocalization, some of that is lighting up the areas in your brain that light up with music. Birds also, of course, listen to music and listen to bird song. So this level of sophisticated processing goes all the way back to a very early evolutionary stage. And this was a pretty cool thing. This is the first time anybody's ever done MRI of reptiles. I'm still amazed that they chose crocodiles instead of, Gila monsters or something a little smaller. And the method does work for cold-blooded organisms, which nobody had ever established before. So it's going to be really interesting to see where they take this. Now, that's not useful, but it's a fun science fact. This is one that's useful, particularly for the students in the audience. Dark chocolate, and also for those of us who are aging. This came out of two studies presented at the Experimental Biology meeting in San Diego a little while ago. Consuming dark chocolate that has a high concentration of cacao has a positive effect on stress levels, inflammation — we knew about the inflammation — mood, memory, and immunity. So the recipe, my friends, is it needs to be at least 70%. And I actually have purchased online, a patient turned me onto this, 100% cacao wafers. So they have no sweetness at all. They kind of melt in your mouth slowly. But he's on a ketogenic diet, and so this is what he uses to kind of get through the day and stay in ketosis. So I thought that was quite interesting. I bought some. And now I'm going to have to start actually using them, because the research on neurologic functioning was just astonishing. They had a positive impact on cognition, memory, mood. We know about the antioxidants, and one of the studies I'll just read you, they looked at pro-inflammatory and anti-inflammatory cytokines, which are the little cellular signals, information packets that get sent between cells, and your immune system runs on cytokines. And the cacao upregulates multiple of the signal pathways involved in the activation of T cells, which are your main cells for fighting against viruses and for fighting against cancer. So cellular immune responses were also improved, and so that would be the macrophages and some of the other immune cells. The genes involved in neural signaling and sensory perception were also upregulated by the cacao. So you started making RNA. So the way this works, DNA is the storage form. It's like the encyclopedia of everything that makes us up. And then RNA is how you turn that into a physical thing called a protein. So the RNA is you open up the DNA like a zipper and you copy the code and you make essentially like a mold of the code. And then you take that mold and you plug it into a protein processor and you build a protein according to the three-letter code. So each three-letter code of DNA, three letters equals one amino acid. And so you plunk that amino acid on, and then you plunk the next one on. And so you end up building this long, wiggly structure, which as you build it, it actually twists and folds up on itself because it's semi-magnetic. And you end up with a shape, and that shape might be flat, like the beta pleated sheet that forms collagen and other structural body tissues. Or it might be very, very complicated two or three strings of DNA, like hemoglobin or insulin. And so these molecules are directly being read off the DNA. So we can look now, because we're so good at this, it's amazing what we can look at inside a cell. We can say, oh, we just triggered the production of new structures in the cell that are now going to be released into the bloodstream. And we can see that we did that with our cacao. And so that's all very cool, and it's cool that we can see it. But the other study I find even more interesting, they used EEGs. So they gave people 48 grams of dark chocolate, which is, if I do the calorie count, you know, roughly 200 calories worth of dark chocolate. So you could figure out how many squares that is, but it's a small chocolate bar. And then after 30 minutes, they looked at their EEG and they looked at something called gamma frequency, which is the EEG spikes that are 25 to 40 beats a second. And those are the ones that are associated with learning and remembering. So building new synapses, being able to adapt and learn new things, it's associated with EEG state in that range, the gamma range. And one of the things that happens as you age and develop Alzheimer's is you lose your gamma. And that's part of what makes it hard to form new memories. Because this electrical beat, if you will, that's going on in the brain stimulates the actual growth of the dendrites off of the neurons, which then allows for new synapses and new connections to be made. You could do this with a couple of tablespoons of cacao in your smoothie. I put a tablespoon of cacao in my breakfast every day when just gets dumped into my smoothie along with a whole bunch of other things, because I don't like swallowing pills. The problem's the sugar. So it's got to be at least 70%. And, you know, you can get some very tasty 85% cacao out there. And so that's the one I'm probably going to target, because I don't think I can choke down these 100% wafers. I'm certainly going to suggest that people take it when they're studying, particularly for exams. And when they're, I would think for languages, this would be particularly useful, because that's really requires the formation of many, many new synapses. So a little chocolate a day makes the brain function better. I'm all over it. I was honored to be one of four people who was invited, well, actually three people who were invited out of all of the hundreds of certified functional medicine doctors. So that was quite an honor to go back to Walter Reed and teach a segment on how functional medicine can help pain. Functional medicine is a term that refers to a biological systems approach that, instead of dividing things up into, let's say, we've got the respiratory system and the cardiovascular system and the digestive system, it looks at the sort of things that all of these systems do, like become inflamed or have a structural issue or have an energy issue because there's a problem with mitochondria, or because hormones influence all of these tissues. So we are thinking globally about all of the factors that influence health and disease. And it's particularly useful for things like complex chronic disease. And if you get, let's say, yellow fever, which, by the way, is why Walter Reed is named after Walter Reed, because he was the guy that figured out that yellow fever was transmitted by a particular mosquito species so that they could finish building the Panama Canal. Functional medicine is the same information, the same science, but it reframes it into a model that's more like, okay, what can we support? What can we take away? What's poisoning this system? what can strengthen and reinforce it, rather than how do we swat the disease. See, the problem is that infectious disease model has invaded the way we approach systems. So, for example, I have a patient who just texted me and said, well, they want to put me on this antibody that will prevent my bones from making osteoclasts to treat my osteoporosis. And it's like, that assumes that the only thing that antibody is going to do is affect osteoporosis. And the odds are that it's going to affect other things as well, because everything affects everything else. And if you walk into a complex disease with the idea that your drug is going to be a magic bullet, it's usually not, and you usually end up causing downstream unintended side effects. Now, if you're giving, you know, let's say a week of antibiotics for an infection, that's an external invasion that just happened to you. And we don't catch heart disease, right? We don't catch diabetes. It's not something that happens to us because a foreign invader comes in and gives it to us, that, you know, swatting the invader is going to take care of the problem. So functional medicine looks at the emergent conditions that are necessary for the development, the emergence of a chronic disease, and says, how can we alter these emergent conditions such that we either mitigate or eliminate the chronic disease? And in fact, it's a much more powerful approach. So, you know, you can throw all the opiates that you want at pain. And for the Walter Reed folks, they, you know, they've been there, done that. They're running into, like, well, that's a dead end for a lot of reasons. For one thing, and for military readiness, if you've got all of your troops stoned, you really have a problem. So if people are out there in the field and they give themselves back pain, you know, moving crates or something, setting, you know, this is not a good situation to be giving a lot of opiates. So what else can you do? And it turns out that functional medicine can have a profound effect on the readiness or the threshold of the body to feel inflammation, which is the root of all pain, is primarily inflammatory. And there's a few neurologic conditions that cause pain that is sensed in the brain. But for the most part, if you feel pain, it's going to respond to aspirin or ibuprofen. If it responds to aspirin or ibuprofen, it's inflammatory, because that's the mechanism of action of that drug. So, of course, there's downstream problems with taking aspirin or ibuprofen every day, and we won't get into that. But you can shift things with diet. Turns out the military diet, we did a little field trip through the cafeteria at Walter Reed, which, you know, you would expect better of a hospital. But essentially, the diet is a pro-inflammatory diet. So it's going to trigger lots of insulin. It's got a lot of trans fat. It's got a lot of saturated fat. These are pro-inflammatory agents as well. It doesn't have much healthy fat. And so I was looking, walked around, I was trying to pretend, is there anything here that I, knowing what I know about nutrition, would actually eat? And I found one thing, and I wasn't too sure about that, which was some oversteamed vegetables and some marinara sauce. But, you know, it's not like man does not live on oversteamed vegetables alone. I couldn't find a single protein I was willing to eat. And the fish was basically soaked in bread, and everything else was... It was disappointing, and hopefully we could make a really fundamental shift institutionally. But just educating the troops about selecting and providing, you know, fruits and vegetables available for snacks, with the kind of encouragement and education to, you know, you should always eat a couple pieces of fruit every day. Here it is. That would make a huge difference in how inflamed, if someone did throw out his back, how much it would hurt. One of us was a chiropractor, and one of us was a anesthesiologist, and then I was the family practice doctor, and I was so impressed with these young doctors that I met, and so really, really happy to see how focused and non-burned out they were, because I was wondering if they would just kind of be defeated and burned out, but they were really ready to hear this information and take it home and try to... succeed at shifting the lifestyles of their patients, and particularly the patients who've got a lot of stuff going on where they're trapped in a loop. I was also impressed with the amount of biofeedback and ear acupuncture and mind-body stuff that we saw. We went by the addiction center, and they were doing a ton of very sophisticated mind-body work. Well, for example, if you've got, let's say you've got an addiction to, let's pick opiates, for example, but it could also be true of alcohol, it could be true of tranquilizers, your brain changes. that neuroplasticity we were talking about with the cacao, your brain actually kind of grows itself a different shape and structure, which then serves to be the underlying condition that perpetuates the emergent addiction. So in order to shift that back, you have to actually practice thinking differently. And as you think differently, here's a good example. Associational pathways are very, very firm triggers. Did you ever smoke? Did you try to quit smoking? When you walked by a place where you used to go hang with the guys and smoke, or had the cup of coffee or the beer or whatever it is that's linked to smoking, initially there's this little reflex that says, oh yeah, I'd like a cigarette right now, because you have this association. So breaking those associations is super important. So when a person, usually when they were hurting, would go get some Vicodin and you are trying to get them off opiates, instead what they're going to do is they're going to listen to a very good sort of self-hypnosis visualization thing that causes them to imagine that they're floating in a cool pool of water and they're feeling the water twinkling their toes and, you know, touching their body. And so you shift your focus away from the pain and away from the desire for the opiate. And you're literally restructuring your response to the pain perception. There's physical addiction and physical changes that right themselves if you stay away from the substance. It takes variable amounts of time. It's maybe 3 days to get the nicotine out of your system. And after that, you're no longer physically craving nicotine, but you're emotionally craving the nicotine for much longer than that. And with opiates, your natural endorphins, this receptors for your natural body opiates, have actually shifted, physically shifted, when you take heavy doses. And so when you come off of your opiates and withdraw, either whether you do it cold turkey or by gradual withdrawal, you will for a short period of time, months, relatively short in a lifetime, have a more acute pain sense. You'll have essentially a lower pain threshold than you would otherwise have had until your opiate receptors get back to where they would have been if you hadn't messed with them in the first place with high doses of opioids. So there's lots that can be done with mind-body manipulations. It's been very well studied, but very impressive. And about 50% of those doctors had already been trained in some acupuncture. So two more, the big ones. Helping your liver. You know, we all are subjected to toxins. Our liver has to deal with those. Some of us take those toxins voluntarily. And this study was done to elaborate the mechanism and establish that nutmeg is actually a very, very good thing to give people to prevent liver damage. So nutmeg would be something I would start adding to your coffee, for example, if you're drinking coffee, which has also got a lot of good antioxidants in it. And it tastes pretty good in coffee, so it won't be that much of a strain. It actually is highly protective of the liver against toxins. And in this study, they were primarily using a mouse animal model of human liver toxicity to establish it. And they discovered the actual receptor. So there's a thing called PPAR alpha that nutmeg jumps right onto, and PPAR alpha is sitting on the liver cell on the outside. And when the nutmeg jumps onto it, it turns a switch inside the cell that generates protective compounds, again, regulating DNA. And then the other one, I want to talk about reducing inflammation with baking soda. So you know that stuff about the alkaline diet and alkaline water and all of that. And I've always felt like, yeah, you know, you could get the same. It's true that, you know, an alkaline cellular environment probably improves all these things, and that an acidic cellular environment is bad for you and probably contributes to cancer and all of that. Yeah, that's true biologically. But you don't have to go and get fancy. You can just eat a lot of vegetables and drink some bicarbonate of soda. So as far as the alkaline water is concerned, buy some club soda and put a quarter teaspoon of, or regular, if you want it, don't want it fizzy, regular water, and put about a quarter teaspoon of bicarbonate of soda in it and drink that every day. So it turns out that a quarter teaspoon of bicarbonate is highly anti-inflammatory, and the mechanism for this is very, very cool. So all of our internal organs are covered by these cells called mesothelial cells. And The mesothelial's derived from the mesoderm. When we're embryos, we have three layers, and the ectoderm turns into our nerves, and it turns into our skin, and the endoderm turns into the lining of the guts. But the mesoderm turns into all the organs, and the surface of the organs is covered with mesothelial cells, and they're like lubricant. They keep, so that when your liver and your stomach rub together, they don't hurt each other. So it allows everything in your guts to slosh around.
WD-40 of the body.
Bingo. But it's also got these little tiny microvilli with taste buds on them. And they taste bacterial byproducts. So they understand whether there's an invader, whether there's bacteria, and then they tell the immune system, they signal the spleen directly, and the spleen, by rubbing against it, I guess tapping on it in code, I'm not quite sure what the mechanism is. Mesothelial cells tell the spleen, okay, time to send a red alert signal, because all of the white cells in the body pass through the spleen every couple of heartbeats. So your white blood cells are ready to pick up the message as they pass through the spleen, which is a big filter. It takes out damaged cells, but the good ones are allowed to pass through. But they pass through with a message. So now the mesothelial cells are actually sending acetylcholine to the spleen, and the spleen is sending acetylcholine to the white blood cells. And acetylcholine, by the way, you can increase by meditation. So it kind of pulls together this whole mind-body thing and how meditation is anti-inflammatory, but also you can get some anti-inflammatory stuff signaling going by just drinking some bicarbonate. And they looked at what's going on in the bloodstream, and they found that macrophages, these big eater cells that are like giant amoeba that go and eat up everything, and they're super, super important in immunity, because they're the cells, they eat the back, let's say you give someone a vaccine. It's a little piece of a bacteria or a little piece of a virus, that vaccine. The macrophage is the one who eats that, says, oh, this shouldn't be here, sweeps it up, and says, this looks like something we want to make antibodies against. And it will actually poke out the fragment onto its surface and call over a T cell. We were talking about T cells a few minutes ago. Call over a T cell, hey, dude, check this out. I need you to start attacking this. So it'll activate the T cell, and the T cell will then go on to activate B cells to make antibodies. And so in the process of this is going to the root of immunity and causing the macrophages to be less likely to look at this fragment and say, yeah, we better attack this. Instead say, yeah, I think we can just let that sit. So I wouldn't do the bicarb if you have an infection or you're trying to fight off a disease. But if your problem is autoimmunity, like rheumatoid arthritis or inflammation, which is what most of us have got as we age, this might be a very strategic thing to try. It was like, here, you can check out this little book. And it's basically a series of, I think they called it the chill book or something. And you could also see how it would work for PTSD. You imagine being told by a nice voice that you are receiving a massage, or that you're a giant cat and you're being stroked. I mean, you can imagine all sorts of really powerful things with your brain. When you're guided by a voice, it's more effective. And so I was so just impressed to see that these things were available to any GI who wanted to walk in and check one out. I thought I would share with you a fun science fact, which I came across in preparing for the program. First of all, we're a very, very inefficient industry, healthcare, and the reimbursement model is crazy. I think most people recognize that when they see those EOBs that they can't, make heads nor tails of, and that price is not the price, and all the things that we've talked about from time to time on this program. But this just underlines it. In non-healthcare industries, the number of employees that it takes to collect your revenue is about 100 people for each $1 billion in goods or services that you sell. Somebody has to keep track of the accounts receivable and send out the letters and the bills and, all of that. So that was 100 people per $1 billion. In healthcare, it's 770 people per $1 billion collected. I can tell you all about why. For one thing, you have very, very strict and Byzantine billing rules and coding rules, which, if I buy a widget from I order a widget. It's R5221, and that is a unique identifier for that widget from that company. But they've gone into the serious weeds here with the codes and identifications that we have to do in medicine. So it's gotten to the point where there is a special code for being bit by an orca. And then there's a subcode for whether or not it broke the skin. There is injured by exploding motorcycle. I mean, the fine-tuning on this, it's almost impossible to figure out how to word it to get the exact correct code. If you don't have the correct code, somebody at the insurance end says, oh, this is not the right code, sends it back and says, please rebill with the correct code. So that's step number one. Step number two, this isn't the right code because they didn't transcribe it properly. Nowadays, what happens is you can't bill entirely online. So a typo is generated when somebody takes a look at what they did get and literally has to put it into another computer system to continue the process. We're spending about $500 billion a year that is quote-unquote healthcare dollars on, and this type of healthcare spending we don't need. So we're spending, all these people are getting paid to push paper at each other, make phone calls at each other, and sit on hold and listen to each other's hold music so that eventually the doctor can get paid. Now, at a very streamlined hospital in, where was this? I guess they don't actually say in this where the hospital was, but they studied this. And they figured out that the billing activities cost about 25% of the revenue for ER. And let's see, 15% of revenue for primary care. So when you do the math, a primary care doctor was spending $99,000 on employee expenses to collect money that they were due. Literally, for many primary care doctors, by the way, 110, 120 is pretty average in terms of income. So you're basically spending almost as much as you make to get anything. It's just insane, and it's extraordinarily abused by the insurance companies with delaying tactics and just all sorts of things, and also cheating. There's a lot of cheating. Just making a comment about what I can't get out of my head, which is those pictures of those kids being separated from their parents, the knowledge of the trauma that something like that can have and the long-term effects it can have. Which brings me to my first science story, which is adversity early in life linked with more physical pain in adulthood. And this is one in another series of the accumulating literature around this concept of adverse childhood experiences. Before I talk about the specific study that I've got in mind here, I just want to tell you about the adverse childhood experience literature, because it was started way back in about 1995. By Kaiser, and they recruited a bunch of people, thousands of people, and they were, I think the average age was like 57 at the time, 17,337 participants, so a very big number, and about half of them are female, about 75% are white, and about 75% attended college. So this was effectively a privileged group, and we could anticipate that perhaps they would have somewhat better access to healthcare and somewhat better nutrition in childhood. So that being said, they went on to ask these people about 10 different types of adverse experiences: physical abuse, emotional abuse, sexual abuse, neglect, exposure to domestic violence, like seeing your father hit your mother, household substance abuse. Was there an alcoholic or someone strung out on something in the home? Was there mental illness in the home in another individual? Did the parents divorce? Or was there a incarcerated household member? So most of us have at least one of those. And, you know, the person who gets through without any of those things, God bless them. You were a very lucky person. But about 28% of the participants, a fairly high number, reported physical abuse. About 21%, one in five, reported sexual abuse. And I'll tell you, I think that that number might even actually be larger, since many people who are sexually abused early on block it out and aren't willing to admit it to themselves, much less to the friendly lady with the clipboard from Kaiser. But it's interesting because there's a dose response experience with all sorts of diseases that you wouldn't expect to be connected. So, for example, heart disease, cancer, chronic lung disease, shortened lifespan. You might expect high-risk behaviors like smoking or alcohol or drug abuse, but the other diseases that I've mentioned there were pretty substantially a doubling of the risk of getting cancer. Is if your score was above 6, you have a 3,000% increase in your risk of attempted suicide. So the people at Kaiser were, you know, trying to get together a tool that would allow them to understand what's going on here. And because we have the ability to look at DNA and to look at the biochemistry, what they discovered was that the structural development of the brain and the chemicals that are turned on or turned off in the brain and the level to which they are turned up or turned down are all affected long-term by these adverse childhood experiences. And they have effects on the adrenal glands, they have effects on the thyroid, other processes of the body, and they screw up your sleep. That's one of the primary things that you see. Screwed up sleep leads to a shortened lifespan. It also leads to increased perception of pain, which brings me to this article, which did a adverse childhood event score on, they had about 300 people in this study. It was in the Journal of Behavioral Medicine. And these were adults, and they scored them on, you know, how much pain do you have? How score your pain from, you know, 0 to 10, like we do now with pain. And there was a substantial increase in the amount of pain in this group, who in the ones, the higher the adverse childhood event score, even though this was long ago, 30, 40 years ago, they consistently had significantly higher pain scores. And that's kind of depressing because it seems like, okay, I had bad crap happen to me in childhood and now I'm doomed. But actually, these researchers had a little gleam of sunshine here because they also did personality tests. And what they found was that the mindset of the individual, if they were optimistic or if they were in control or felt like they were in control of their pain, they had a close to normal score when they broke it out. Those people were the ones who were optimistic, the ones who felt like they had control over their pain and they could do something about it, were getting close to the normal levels of pain. And so what this suggests is that when we have, as physicians or as counselors or as family members, a person who has a childhood adverse event, what we need to do with that individual is work on compensating for that adverse childhood event. Don't let them assume that the universe is hostile. Teach them that the universe is kind. Teach them to be optimistic. Teach them to expect things to turn out well by taking that person under your wing and making sure they have successes as they grow up, making sure that they get... one of my aunts, I think, did this. I never did figure out who did it. But you know the things on the back of cereal boxes back in the 60s where there would be like a toy if you sent in 3 cornflakes boxes? Well, periodically, once every couple of months, I would get one of these premiums that I hadn't sent for. And it was from a secret admirer. It was sent as a gift. Now, nowadays, if that happened with a child, everyone would get totally creeped out. But back in the old innocent 60s, people said, oh, how sweet. You have a secret admirer and they sent you a present. Yeah, I'm kind of a relentlessly optimistic person. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that I had a good childhood. I expected good things to happen to me. And I walked through life with that expectation. And it's like confirmation bias, you know? It's like when things go wrong, it's an aberrancy. It, you know, sooner or later, your luck has to turn. But for the most part, things have gone well. And it's a matter of understanding that we can train in resilience. If we can treat autism, which is a much deeper abnormality of the brain, we can treat and train in resilience so that people who've had a bad start or a bad event don't get locked into this negative loop that then leads to all of the suffering in adulthood. And if we're talking about, let's say, somebody who's in their 60s, who's got chronic pain, who's had 3 failed marriages and is clinically depressed, that's going to be a much tougher person than a 5-year-old who got taken away from his parents by ICE and got traumatized in a one of those cold cells and finally got released to social workers and ended up in a foster home for a couple of months. Yeah, I think that in the second case, we need to devote some resources to that child. And certainly when there is an event like a school shooting or other adverse childhood events that occur as a result of, you know, somebody acting out, perhaps school shootings being the one that comes to mind, they're in there with the counselors now and working with these kids and doing their very best to make sure that this is viewed as an aberrancy and not some kind of lethal fate, you know, ill-fatedness that's going to follow you for the rest of your life. Because once you lock into that expectation, you probably create a self-fulfilling prophecy. And I think it's an internal biochemical phenomenon that gets ingrained and it gets harder and harder. It develops more and more momentum over time. So I do think when you're dealing with that 60-year-old with those health problems that I invented, that you may just be in the situation of helping patch that, but without being really able to bring that person back to a different personality. But with a 5-year-old, yeah, you stand a chance. So I'm going to do a quick email, and this is from Audra in Santa Cruz, who wanted to know what I thought of Stephen Gundry and his prebiotic supplements. And she sent me a link, and I looked at it. So in a word, overpriced prebiotic supplements, the next wave in alternative healthcare. Prebiotics is basically fiber. So this stuff has a bunch of good fiber in it. The best and cheapest source of prebiotics is things like sauerkraut. Yogurt has prebiotics in it. Jicama, Jerusalem artichoke, one of the best sources of these compounds, which are basically undigestible fiber. But you want to give fiber that the good bacteria like to eat. Because like I was talking about with, you know, mutating the bacteria so they could eat seaweed and then using that to bias the microbiome of the mice. If you feed the microbiome their native diet, they grow and thrive and are able to take over a larger swath of territory. And so you get the bugs you want by feeding them what you should. So it's very interesting. It can be done cheaply at the supermarket. Pick up some flaxseed, pick up some jicama, eat a different root vegetable every day, especially those Jerusalem artichokes. Good stuff. I want to talk to you about swimming pools because this was a CDC study that just blew my head off. Cryptosporidium, there were basically all of these disease outbreaks from hotel pools and hotel jacuzzis. And you should stay out of hotel pools is basically the moral here. And don't go underwater and definitely don't swallow the water because cryptosporidium, which is a parasite that causes really nasty vomiting and diarrhea, it lasts for weeks. It can live in chlorine and live for days in perfectly well-maintained pools and hot tubs where the dipstick is just right and it looks pristine, and this little parasite swimming around. And you know, pools, you get kids in diapers. You get kids who poop in the pool. They don't drain the pool. You know, they just throw in a little extra chlorine. They quote-unquote shock the pool. It doesn't kill the crypto. So this is a really, really big deal. Do not go underwater. Do not swallow the water in. If you must go into the swimming pool in a hotel, my suggestion is keep your head above water. Let's talk about e-cigarettes. You know, they're one of my favorite things. And we're talking about benzene, ethylene oxide, acrylonitrate, acrylamide, lots of lovely polysyllabic toxins in this stuff. And we're finding that there are these volatile organic compounds that are getting into the users of e-cigarettes. Now, regular cigarettes are worse. But the scary thing about the e-cigarettes is the flavorings that they've got. They've got this like fruit flavoring that people like, and, you know, younger people are getting like, you know, Fruity Pebbles tasting cigarettes. And it's basically these flavorings, when they're heated, become actively carcinogenic. But they're approved as flavorings for food because they aren't heated to the temperatures that you get when you vape. The other really scary thing is that people, young people, are twice as likely to move on to cigarettes if they start with vaping. With adults, that's not true. With adults, people actually kind of step off of cigarettes onto e-cigarettes, and it reduces their toxic exposures because they're already smokers. But with kids, they would never touch a cigarette. Your first puff of the cigarette, it's just awful, and you choke, right? It's terrible, but that's not the case when it's, you know, juicy fruit gum flavored vape that it's just cool, you know, and from there you move towards real cigarettes. So it doubles, if you vape as a teenager, it doubles your risk of being a smoker at 20. I thought I might take a moment and explain what's going on there about blood pressure, that whenever you have a squirt of adrenaline, which is every time you're excited, nervous, apprehensive, any kind of arousal, basically, whenever you have that arousal happen, whether for a good or a bad reason, you get a little squirt of adrenaline in your bloodstream. And the immediate reflex of the muscles that surround the walls of the blood vessels is to make them contract. And then that contraction actually triggers the release at the cell level. So the lining actually is alive, and the lining actually makes a tissue, a substance in its tissue called nitric oxide. And the nitric oxide is like a muscle relaxant for the walls of the blood vessels. So what normally happens is that you get a relaxation from the nitric oxide that opens up the pathways so that you can pipe blood to your muscles, get ready to run from the tiger, pipe blood to other areas of the body for other reasons, but basically increase blood flow by opening up blood vessels. And it's the adrenaline that, while it triggers contraction, actually acts as a signal to make things open up through the nitric oxide. And the problem is, as we get older, the lining of the blood vessels gets a little damaged, and it's not quite as quick on the uptake for releasing that nitric oxide. So people get, when they have fear or they have anxiety, their blood pressure goes up. We call that white coat hypertension, and people are generally told, oh, that's harmless. But actually what it says is that you have a nitric oxide production problem. And, you know, sometimes in some men in their 40s or 50s may notice that they don't get quite as strong an erection as they used to. That's also mediated by nitric oxide. So guess what food is a really effective treatment for this white coat hypertension? It's beets. Yeah, beets. 1 cup of raw beet juice a day can markedly reduce blood pressure and eliminate white coat hypertension. And this comes out of a study center in Iran. They used fresh beet juice, cooked beets, and basically about 8 ounces of raw beet or 8 ounces of cooked beets every day for 2 weeks. And then they looked at their blood pressure, and basically it lowered systolic blood pressure by 7 millimeters, which is a very, very good amount. That'd get any drug approved, by the way. The cooked beet juice didn't work quite as well as the raw, according to the study, but daily beet consumption, particularly if you can manage raw beets, made a big difference in blood pressure. There were also studies looking at inflammatory levels in the blood vessel wall, and those were also improved by beets. Beets actually also have some compounds that are anti-cancer, and it's anti-inflammatory as well, so they're pretty good for you. And if you're having issues with blood pressure or starting to worry that you might be getting in that direction, the other food that I often will put people on is celery seed or celery juice, because celery is a natural calcium channel blocker. So it acts like one of our commonly used pharmaceuticals for lowering high blood pressure. And beets also can be fermented. You can make a nice kimchi with cabbage and beets. It's really quite tasty. Those are some good strategies for lowering BP. But anyone who's got white coat hypertension, I just don't want them to be falsely reassured. Next science story is about folic acid. This was a large study called the China Stroke Primary Prevention Trial. And they looked at 20,000 Chinese adults with hypertension. They were trying to, one of the things they looked at was whether or not giving them folic acid, they were using 800 micrograms, would, plus a blood pressure medicine, would be better than just giving the blood pressure medicine alone. And they also looked at cancers, and what they found was no significant difference in cancer rates, no significant difference in stroke rates in the general population of those 20,000 people. But when they took the people who have a mutation in their folic acid metabolism, fairly common, it's 3% have 2 copies of the bad DNA and 10% have 1 copy of the bad enzyme. And it makes it harder for your body to process folic acid, which is very important in preventing cancer, making neurotransmitters, avoiding diabetes, energy processing, keeping the mitochondria alive, tons of things that are all important and reliant on folic acid. So when what they did was they went back to that group, the group that had that mutation. In those, when they treated them with folic acid, they got a 53% reduction in cancers. So very, very substantial reduction in that group. So the point being, folic acid supplementation in the population can't be shown to do anything. But if you're one of these vulnerable individuals, you should be taking folic acid, or even better, methylated folate, which skips the enzyme step. And I think in the United States, since our food is all enriched with B vitamins, at least it is if you eat grains, what we really should be doing was finding these people, which I try to do, identifying that cohort in the population and giving them methylated folate. Now, it's kind of frustrating for me because I was screening all of my patients at their physicals with a test called homocysteine. And if it was abnormal, that suggests a problem with this DNA. So I would order the MTHFR test, which is a DNA test. Medicare recently decided to stop paying for this test. And it's expensive enough. It's about over $100 that I now can't get it as a screening test on my patients. But while it was being covered, I must have found 50 cases of people with MTHFR mutation and elevated homocysteine, which is evidence that it's adversely affecting them. Well, along with back to school, it looks like pertussis is back. Now, pertussis, that's whooping cough, has a cyclic nature of coming back, in at least in our state of California, every 3 to 5 years. That's because, well, guess what? How long does the immunity last after exposure? You guessed it, 2 to 4 years. Since the 1st of September, the Santa Cruz County Public Health Division has gotten 16 reports of new pertussis cases, and there have been a couple of outbreaks. One, an elementary school in Aptos, had 8 confirmed pertussis cases, and 55% of kindergartners became cases because, well, of those confirmed cases, 75% of them were unvaccinated. Adults are also vulnerable to pertussis. It manifests a little bit differently in that adults and teenagers don't usually get the whooping cough aspect. They don't make that sound. But the most important thing to look for is a cough lasting more than a week. And particularly if you get coughing spells where you either vomit or come close to vomiting. Post-tussive vomiting is one of those hallmarks of pertussis. And unfortunately, it's really contagious. It happens through the inhalation of small droplets that the person who's infected has coughed out, and it takes about 7 to 10 days to incubate. And it initially looks like a cold, just a fatigue, runny nose, and a mild cough. There's usually no fever. After a couple of weeks, you start to get this severe, persistent coughing spells, and this can last up to 10 weeks. And it just slowly, slowly gets better. Most infected people are contagious for about 2 weeks after that cough starts. And if you do give antibiotics, because this is a bacteria, you can reduce the frequency of infection and also maybe reduce the duration of the cough a little bit. The real problem is that there's nothing to distinguish this from just a bad chest cold until it's really too late for the antibiotics to do much. And we don't want to go back to treating every cold with antibiotics. So what's the solution? Well, you probably know where I'm going with this: vaccination. There is an adult tetanus pertussis vaccine. It lasts at least 2 and probably more like 4 years. And aside from a sore arm, there's nothing dangerous about getting this vaccine every 5 years. Which is, we have more and more unvaccinated people. I'm beginning to think about recommending this to my older patients who are much more vulnerable to being hospitalized if they get this sort of an infection. There is a blood test for pertussis, which is accurate, and there's also a culture, so it can be diagnosed relatively quickly. The group that is most in danger is infants, and so if those children who contract pertussis in kindergarten have a younger brother or sister, particularly an infant under 1 year of age, well, that whooping cough
is very serious in an infant and can actually lead to death. Just for your information, if this turns bad and becomes widespread and you're a person with an infant, vaccination for pertussis can begin as young as the age of 6 weeks and still be effective. On the subject of infection, one of the things that those of us who proudly vaunt our, in my case, 4.25% Neanderthal DNA, neener, neener. Well, anyway, part of that DNA, apparently, is some really effective genes, 152 of them, to be exact, that help people fight off influenza and hepatitis virus. Most Europeans and Asians have about 2% Neanderthal DNA. This is due to two periods of interbreeding, one 100,000 years ago and one about 50,000 years ago. But every silver lining has a cloud, and those people with higher amounts of Neanderthal DNA may also be somewhat more likely to carry genes that are associated with the development of old age Alzheimer's. So this may account for the phenomenon that I, as well as many physicians, have noted, that many Alzheimer's patients are, for their age, extremely physically healthy. Their increased ability to fight off infection and avoid disease may in fact set them up for more brain inflammation that aggravates the slings and arrows that we're subject to through our life as far as brain health is concerned. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.